Hello, listeners. It is Thursday, September 21st, 2017. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. Lots to talk about, as usual, this week. We are going to kick off, though, with healthcare. We've done it a few times already this year. Once again, Republican efforts in Congress are ramping up to pass an Obamacare replacement healthcare bill. This time, it's in the Senate. It's being led by Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy. And they are operating on a tight deadline, but they think they might have the formula put together to get at least 50 Republican votes in the Senate, kick things over to the House, and fulfill this long campaign promise that they've had to repeal Obamacare. So we are going to talk about what's in that bill, what some of the political implications could be. We're also going to check in with the Alabama Senate race. That primary on the Republican side is coming up on Tuesday, a big race with Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and a lot of others invested in that race. We're going to talk about where the polling stands, the different personalities in play there, and what might happen on Tuesday. And then at the end, we're going to take a quick check-in with President Donald Trump's approval ratings. It's doing something it hasn't done in a little while. It's actually going up. We're going to talk about why that might be, whether we can trust that as a long-term trend or not, and other stuff going on in the White House right now. Before we jump into all that, a few quick housekeeping notes. Remember, if you have questions, please email us at nerdcast@politico.com. We'd love to hear from you. Along the same lines, please remember to subscribe, rate us, and if you have time, write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform. We love getting feedback. It gives us an opportunity to grow the audience even further and make the Nerdcast even better. So please review us, rate us, subscribe, all the above. All right, without any further ado, let's kick it off this week. Welcome back, Nancy Cook, White House reporter.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And making his Nerdcast debut this week, we have healthcare editor Adriel Bettelheim.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So we are going to jump right into healthcare for our first segment. And our first data point is $28 to $50 billion. Now, that's a pretty wide range, but there's a new healthcare bill in the works among Senate Republicans. It would give states huge leeway to craft their own healthcare systems, and it would move around a lot of federal money going to those states. So that range that we just gave you is according to three or four separate studies that are flying around out there, and there are still more coming because this legislation is new and moving very quickly. But according to a few different studies, that's the range of money that the state of California could lose compared to what it's getting under current law over the next decade or so for healthcare. So, Adriel, tell us more about the bill, the Graham, Cassidy, Heller, Johnson bill now, I think. Why it's moving so quickly and what is in it?
Well, this is somewhat a rehash of earlier Obamacare repeal bills that the Senate took up this year. But what they would do essentially is repeal the ACA's Medicaid expansion, the insurance subsidies, basically the whole basic health program, and take those dollars and put them into lump sum block grants that the states could then use for whatever they want. They could pay health providers directly. They could help cover high-risk patients. No real federal mother may I aspect to this, and that's a big selling point to the red states. It would also notably convert the traditional Medicaid program from an open-ended entitlement into a capped system, and that's a very big ideal that's been a conservative goal since, boy, before the Reagan years.
It would supply a set amount of money as opposed to covering everyone under a certain level of income.
Instead of an open-ended. Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, really changing a fundamental great society entitlement program. Why are they in a rush? Well, they are trying to use a fast-track procedure under budget rules called reconciliation that would take hours to explain to pass this with just a simple majority, in their case 50 votes, with Vice President Pence casting the tiebreaker. And they have until September 30th because under the budget rules that authority would expire. So there's a real ticking clock here. Time is short, and they're really feeling an imperative to make good on this 7-plus-year campaign promise to wipe out Obamacare.
And Nancy, they're feeling an imperative also just to have something to show, like a major policy accomplishment to show for unified control of the government, right? We've talked about this a lot with tax reform and kind of the momentum that's been building with that over the last few weeks, months, however long. But obviously, healthcare has been hanging around there for a while too.
Yeah, it's interesting. And among you know, people that I talk to in the White House and conservative outside groups, there is this sense that there's a little bit of disappointment that healthcare has cropped back up. You know, the White House has never been terribly engaged on healthcare, particularly the president. It's not an issue that he feels passionate about. And I think they were really thinking, okay, healthcare, we failed to repeal Obamacare, but we put it to bed, and now we're going to do tax reform. And they had planned to unveil this big tax plan next week. The timing of that is very fluid now that there's this potential healthcare vote. And so, you know, healthcare could yet again, you know, swamp another legislative victory they're going to have. And healthcare itself may not be a legislative victory. I mean, that really remains an open question whether Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has the votes to repeal it.
Which senators are the most important in this chase for 50 votes, right? It's not because of reconciliation, it's not 60. They bypass the filibuster. They need 50 plus Vice President Mike Pence in order to pass something. So who are the potential swing votes?
So obviously, first of all, no Democrat's going to vote to undercut the ACA. The undecideds, or the ones that are hanging out, the ones that are being most closely watched, are John McCain of Arizona and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who both voted last time at the end of July against that so-called skinny repeal bill. You remember that dramatic vote in the dead of night. And they are both viewed as gettable this time by the supporters of this bill and their authors, Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy. McCain, of course, has a close relationship with Graham on national security and other issues. He was insisting that they follow regular order and not draft this thing behind closed doors. There's this belief that maybe the process this time was a little more open. Murkowski is looking for how it'll affect her state, which is an unusual state, very sparsely populated. And there's some language in this still being negotiated, frankly, that might allow the state to avoid some cuts under the block grants that could be viewed as favorable to Alaska. But we don't know. She's very independent-minded lawmaker, and her independent governor is against this bill. So he's given her a little cover to stay opposed.
Speaking of the governors, I mean, the way that this bill is crafted would potentially load them up with a really big task in front of them, right? Governors and state legislators alike to the opportunity, whether good or not, depending on how they look at it, to totally remake the healthcare system in their state and also be responsible for it in a way that maybe they haven't been in the past. That's a pretty big thing to kind of throw at them all of a sudden in the middle of all this. That wasn't really a facet of the previous bills, right?
Right. I mean, they anticipated giving the states more leeway, the Republicans all along. But this would essentially give governors the responsibility of setting up their own health systems and give them roughly 2 years, since a lot of this kicks in 2020. Recall the problems just setting up Obamacare's website so people could enroll. Can you imagine the complexity of setting up a whole insurance regulatory scheme, whether you're, you know, a very deep red hands-off state or a highly regulated state like a California or a New York that might do something in the spirit of the ACA? It's all on the governors. And I believe there's more than 20 – there's two dozen, at least maybe 27 Republican-held governorships that are up in 2018. You really wonder what's going to happen in states like Ohio or Michigan or Illinois if you get a Democratic candidate who could run on an invigorated healthcare platform. I mean, healthcare is going to be huge in these elections.
Do you feel like the senators this time around have a good grasp of all of the policy decisions that this bill contains? Because I feel like last time, you know, it was so rushed, and a complaint of a lot of people and a hesitation was that they weren't even sure what was in the bill. I mean, I'm a reporter and, you know, I'm not reporting on this story. I'm not even exactly sure what's in the bill. And this is like part of my job to understand these things.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. I mean, some of the lobbyists and the patient advocates that who are up there trying to get their oar in before the vote are fairly astonished at how little the policy seems to matter. I'm not sure. I mean, many of these senators don't come naturally to healthcare. Graham, you know, who's been the chief salesperson for this, says he's bored to death by the details this Cassidy and these others are rattling off. But no, I think now the politics is taking over, and this threat of taking heat from the outside conservative groups you mentioned, from getting more nasty tweets from the president if they fail on this, I think that is really driving them more than the policy considerations.
I mean, I just can't get over the political considerations of on these potential governors who many of whom started their campaigns without thinking that this might necessarily be a big issue. Or even in Virginia, say, we've got a 2017 gubernatorial race happening right now where you could easily see that becoming the single biggest issue of the final month and a half of the campaign or so if Congress and the president suddenly say that they're going to get this money and they're going to be in charge. All of a sudden, that governor and the state legislature there is going to be in charge of what the healthcare system is for the people who live in that state.
Yeah, I could see this as a red state sell. You say, yeah, we're going to lose several billion dollars, but we get total control to shape our system to our needs. We don't have to go on bent knee anymore to the feds in Washington to say impose a work requirement on Medicaid recipients. And I could see that working in a deep red state. In a swing state, that's when it gets real interesting.
Well, tell us a little bit more about how the financial aspect of this breaks down a little bit. We talked a bit about California, right, at the top of this. This bill would move in addition to giving freedom, it would move a lot of money around and change the amounts. It would cut a fair bit. And some senators, Republican senators, have defended that as saying, well, states can be more efficient because when they have this flexibility to set things up the way they want. But how do those cuts break down?
Well, that's still being hashed out. It seems like every few hours we're getting a new breakdown from people like Avalere, the health consultancy, Kaiser Family Foundation has come out with one. I mean, so the numbers are quite all over the place. But if in general, if you were a state that expanded Medicaid under Obamacare, if you carved out generous benefits, if you have a high cost of care because of, say, the way that providers are arrayed around your state, you're going to lose billions of dollars between 2020 and 2026. If you were a holdout state like Texas, you may pick up, by some estimates, $35 billion. But even they're a little concerned because the money cuts off in 2026. You get this cliff, and future Congresses, lucky them, are going to have to decide whether to keep this money going. So even the states that stand to benefit are a little anxious as they're getting more details about this plan.
We have a time deadline to look out for that's a little tighter than usual. What signs are you looking for over the next few days? Obviously, we'll be keeping a very close eye on those few senators that you mentioned as potential swing votes, those Republican senators. I'm also wondering if this does pass, then the House is also going to have to consider this very quickly. And there are a lot more Republican House members from some of these blue states that would stand to lose financially under this than there are in the Senate. And I wonder how that might play out, especially, you know, a lot of them are going to be facing tough reelections, which the Senate map is very tilted toward red states, toward Democrats having tough races in 2018. In the House, it's a much different story. It's Republicans who are kind of extended a little further, you know, beyond the median maybe. And it's also Democrats who are looking to play offense on healthcare for the first time in a while who feel like the landscape has shifted there. So I wonder how that might play out if and when things get to the House.
Well, it's an excellent question. I mean, one thing we're going to be watching early next week is the Congressional Budget Office, as is its habit, is going to be scoring this bill. But it's not going to have time to do a really elaborate score. You'll remember last time they came out with some scary forecasts about coverage losses, and that chilled a lot of support for past repeal efforts. They can't do a thorough analysis in time for this. So that may or may not affect the debate. As you say, the dynamic in the House is totally different. I mean, you can craft something to help a sparsely populated state like the Dakotas or Alaska and get a Senate vote, but it breaks down much differently by congressional district. There is one school of thought that says for every so-called moderate, on-the-fence, ambivalent lawmaker, Republican who peels off and can't can't support this, one of the hard conservative Freedom Caucus or others will come on board and fill in that gap. Because, again, 7+ years of campaign promises, a lot of these people, you know, ran on this when they got to Congress. There's that belief that they will give just enough to get it over the line.
All right. Well, as we so often say here, it's something big developments to watch over the next week. We'll be keeping an eye on it. Thank you so much for coming in to explain it all to us.
Thank you.
All right. For our second segment this week, we are going to shift into the big election story of the week. The Alabama Senate race has a Republican primary runoff actually coming up on Tuesday. And it is going to be the political event to watch over the next week. And so please welcome into the studio. We have senior politics editor Charlie Mutessian back with us.
Hey, Scott.
And campaigns reporter Kevin Robillard.
Great to be here.
Thank you both. All right. So our data point to kick off this discussion is $5 million. And that is how much money the super PAC aligned with Mitch McConnell has spent in Alabama so far. This is Alabama. This is a deep red state. It's going to be a Republican no matter what. But yet, Senate Leadership Fund, very invested in this. Mitch McConnell, very invested in this race against appointed Senator Luther Strange. He's being opposed by former state Supreme Court Justice Roy Moore. Kevin, why? Tell us, what's the state of play here?
So the real state of play here, this isn't a matter where Mitch McConnell is spending a bunch of money, like you said, because they fear that a Democrat could beat Roy Moore, although occasionally operatives aligned with McConnell will be like, maybe he could lose to a Democrat, although not many people really believe that's possible. Alabama is far too red a state. This is a matter of Mitch McConnell, A, has grown to trust and like Luther Strange as a pretty loyal soldier, and B, doesn't want Roy Moore in the Senate. It's that simple. Roy Moore is the kind of guy who could cause a lot of problems. We often forget that, you know, basically the entire Senate runs on unanimous consent. And Roy Moore is the type of guy who will withhold unanimous consent for reasons that will, you know, blow up the Republican Party's image nationally. And so basically they don't trust Roy Moore and don't want him around. So that's why they're ponying up huge, huge amounts of money, particularly for a state like Alabama, to try to beat him.
And we've got it's kind of funny the way the battle lines have gotten drawn in this race, too, because you've got on one side, you've got Mitch McConnell, swamp creature Mitch McConnell, and President Donald Trump backing Luther Strange. And then on the other side, backing Roy Moore, you've got this kind of constellation of Republican rebels who have been trying for the last 5 years now without success to defeat a Republican incumbent. And then also Steve Bannon, the recently departed White House chief strategist, who's Breitbart News is really going hard after Strange. And, you know, it's not exactly the way you would typically expect things to line up.
Yeah. And I think it's been interesting, particularly Trump's calculus here. When Trump endorsed Strange, it's been pretty widely reported that he basically viewed this as he only had two choices, which was Strange or Congressman Mo Brooks, and wasn't really presented with the option of endorsing Moore. So then once it came down to Strange and Moore, it looked for a while like Moore was leading pretty heavily. Trump got pretty quiet about this race and then really only in the last week or so has reengaged. He's sent out a series of tweets praising the man he calls Big Luther. Strange is 6'6", for those who don't know, and played college basketball at Tulane, so the nickname makes a good amount of sense. And really, he's started to get engaged. He's going there on Friday night for a rally. Mike Pence is going there on Monday. He's really also positioning himself pretty well to get most of the credit if Strange does pull off a win, considering how badly Strange was trailing at one point.
Well, I also feel like, you know, the Washington Post had quite an interesting sort of deep dive story on the race this morning. And one point that they made, which I thought was a good one, was that, you know, Strange and the president have good chemistry. That's really important to Trump, sort of having this chemistry with the person. And also Strange has basically said, you know, I will support all your policies. Mm-hmm. You know, he backed the GOP healthcare bill, for instance, this summer. And I think that that is another thing that makes the president like him, even if he doesn't necessarily totally fit into a category of insurgency that his base likes, like Moore does. He's not going to be a problem in the Senate for Trump.
Yeah, I mean, Charlie, Roy Moore is a rare state Supreme Court justice with national name recognition due to what he's done in those positions. He's been kicked off the bench a couple times. Just in the past couple of weeks, he said some really incendiary racial comments.
Yeah, and he's in a long line of Alabama populists to a certain degree. I mean, he's really the last person that McConnell wants in his conference. There's no evidence that he's going to be loyal to his party in any way, as Kevin was mentioning. I mean, he's someone who's going to be making the headlines all the time for all the wrong reasons. And what McConnell is surely thinking about is the idea that every time he makes a headline, all of his members, every member of the Republican conference owns that. Those statements he makes are going to be showing up in reelection campaigns for everyone who's up for a reelection in 2018, 2020. The party owns him lock, stock, and barrel if he gets elected. And think about it from McConnell's perspective. I mean, McConnell is old school. And, you know, he is a guy who built the Republican Party the old-fashioned way in Kentucky when he started. There were no Republicans in Kentucky. He built it from scratch. And there's a way that he views politics. And it's very different than a kind of free agent like Roy Moore. And so you've got that. And then you've got that X factor that's looming over everything, which is Trump's exceptional popularity in Alabama. I mean, we all know that Trump is still popular with Republicans. You know, roughly 80% of Republicans, you know, approve of his performance so far. But In Alabama, he's especially popular, and he has always been popular. It's got a very special place. It has a purchase on Trump's political heart in a way, in part because the first big rally he had was in Mobile. And Alabama has an unusual presence in this White House. I mean, you see other White Houses where when Democrats come in, it tends to be like a state like California or New York or Massachusetts, you know, plays a big role, or it becomes the alpha dog in Washington, gets lots of staff jobs, cabinet positions, folks from those states. In a Republican administration, oftentimes it's Texas, the Republican heartland. Here, it's unusual. You've got lots of staffers in the White House that are from Alabama. The president's AG is from Alabama,
which is why the seat is open,
right? And he is deeply popular in Alabama. So, for all of those reasons, I mean, it just becomes a fantastic race to watch.
Well, and I also think, you know, I went down to an Alabama rally with the president after he won the election in December. And you can just tell he likes being there. Like, he likes the energy. They love him. You know, we were in Mobile. It was just, you know, it was pouring rain. There were still like tons of people there. I feel like the rally tomorrow will be fascinating to watch, because I feel like he loves doing these rallies, campaign style rallies. And Alabama is a place where he feels comfortable and energized.
I can't think of another state where he'd be more popular. Can anyone? I mean, where would he be more popular than Alabama?
West Virginia, maybe?
Oh, maybe. Right. That would be the only other state that mm-hmm. would be in the ballpark of how popular he is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think one thing to watch with this rally is whether he's actually able to transfer this to Strange. Because if you look at, you know, who voted for Moore, it's likely that Moore and Trump share more of a base than Strange and Trump do. And so there was some speculation that maybe sending Trump down there is the wrong thing, because this is going to be an extremely low turnout special election. This is, you know, they sort of intentionally didn't put it on election day so that it would be low turnout. They could have scheduled this so that it would be on the first Tuesday in November, and they didn't. And I think there's been some worry that by drawing so much attention to the race, Trump might sort of alert everyone, oh yeah, this is happening, and then his people might go out and vote for Moore, whereas if Strange had just sort of relied on his money advantage, might have been able to just sort of more selectively target and bring out his voters.
The potential return, though, is so high for Trump, because mm-hmm. everyone knows there's no doubt that if Strange wins, everyone will attribute that to the president. And mm-hmm. and you have to give the president credit for one thing here, which is he has put a lot of skin in the game for his first year in these special elections. He has not dilly-dallied at all. He has not held his cards close to the vest in any of them. He gets out there. He does robocalls. He makes endorsements. He's had a high profile, done tons of tweets for Strange. So he will own that victory. The downside is, if Strange loses, how much of it does Trump own? I don't know. I mean, the way he operates, he will say that Strange was deeply flawed, or he will dust it off and dismiss it. I don't think he will get too much splashback. But if Strange wins, I think that's going to give him a lot of clout among wavering Republicans right now, particularly conservatives.
Well, also Kellyanne Conway in some article this morning was pointing that out. You know, this will be, I think, the fifth special election of the year. And she was sort of making the point that trying to paint Trump's base as sort of broad and expansive, making the point that these special elections have been obviously in different states, different demographic groups, you know, different issues at play. And there was a feeling that if Trump was able to, you know, swing the needle towards Strange in this one, it just shows sort of his power. I also think it sets up potentially an interesting dynamic for 2018.
That's really interesting. So Kevin, what's your read on where things stand at this point? Obviously, with Trump heading down there, the whole point of that is to shake things up a little bit. But I don't think there's been a public poll that has shown Strange leading in this runoff with Roy Moore. And remember, Moore got in the low 40s, Strange got in the low 30s in the first round when they finished in the top two to advance there. But that said about the public polling, that we got this sense that the folks who are looking at this professionally for the campaigns and the PACs that are involved are seeing a little bit of a closer picture.
Yeah. Not only has so there's been no public poll with Strange in the lead, and that includes polls released by groups that support Strange, like Senate Leadership Fund.
And that's usually a bad sign.
Typically a bad sign.
Yeah.
One thing I will note is that most of the public polling that hasn't come from a group aligned with one candidate or the other hasn't been particularly good. Some of the polls have been landline only. They've all had different
flaws.
From
a methodological standpoint.
Yeah, methodological standpoint. So really, most indications are from the polling that Moore is ahead. However, all the polls do show the race tightening, which makes sense considering Moore has been outspent by, you know, roughly 10 to 1. Since
back to that McConnell super PAC,
yeah, because of McConnell super PAC, and because Strange has a good amount of money of his own to spend in this race. So, really, I think most people would say Moore is still a slight favorite, but it's hard to say, particularly because we don't know what kind of impact the president's visit will have. I think it definitely will put more attention on the race, but whether it puts more attention on the race and swings voters to Strange is an open question.
And I question the value of polls in a race like this. You know, as Kevin's talking about, it's not a state that gets a ton of polling to begin with. You know, so we don't see a ton of great polling that comes out of it. And think about who's being polled here. I mean, you're talking about the Trump wing of the party, which pollsters are already struggling with. You know, so in a state that there isn't typically a lot of great polling, you are polling groups of voters who pollsters are really struggling to understand. And so for all those reasons, I think things are really way up in the air in a way that we're not accustomed to in a typical primary.
Mm-hmm. I will say one Republican operative who is working on the Strange side of things told me yesterday that he believes the race is still a coin flip. And I will say that's, you know, he's optimistic about Strange's chances, and he's still only saying it's a coin flip.
One other thing I want to point out with this before we close out the segment is the folks who are backing Moore, there are some of them who are hoping that and again, this is a very unique situation in that Strange has only been a senator for like 7 months at this point. Right. So he's, you know, he's a quasi incumbent at best. But there are groups and operatives out there who have been trying for 4 or 5 years now since Richard Lugar lost in Indiana in 2012 to beat a Republican senator, including Mitch McConnell, in a primary. And they haven't beaten one in the last 5.5 years. And there's this hope among some of them that maybe this race, if Moore is able to win the primary, could inject a little bit of momentum into that kind of waning anti-incumbent movement. Kevin, is there any evidence of that?
Yeah. I mean, they clearly think that this could be something where, you know, if we can beat Luther Strange, then maybe we can, you know, beat Bob Corker if he runs for re-election in Tennessee. Maybe we can beat Roger Wicker in Mississippi. They clearly think that. I will say sort of McConnell world and their allies, which includes groups like the Chamber of Commerce, are very, very proud that they've been able to, you know, sort of beat back these Republican primary challengers, and in some cases kind of crush them over the past 4 years. This is probably as big a scare as they've gotten recently. And they are a little worried that this will encourage more primary challengers because they already have to deal with a bunch. They already have to deal with Danny Tarkanian running against Dean Heller. They have to deal with Kelly Ward and perhaps more people running against Jeff Flake in Arizona. They're worried that some of these primary challengers could, you know, basically suck up a lot of their time, attention, energy, money. And that means that they, you know, every dollar they spend helping Bob Corker win his primary in Tennessee is $1 they can't spend going after Joe Donnelly in Indiana.
I'm certain that this is going to more win is going to embolden what I would call the non-governance wing of the Republican Party, because this is a classic non-governance wing versus the governance wing setup. This is Christine O'Donnell. This is Richard Murdoch. This is Chris McDaniel. And they don't operate by the same rules as the governance wing or the establishment wing, meaning all the establishment candidates are going to run for the Senate. They're already lining up their donors. They're already well underway in their campaigns. But the non-governance wing Republicans, they do it on a whim. They don't need as much money. They run under the radar. A lot of their action happens online. They decide later. So once they see this, once they see that you can base a campaign, a very effective campaign, and take out an incumbent if you have the president's support, and they will look – maybe they'll see here that, well – Moore didn't have the president's support, but they will also look elsewhere. They will listen to what the president is saying in Nevada about Dean Heller. They will see that the president endorsed or backed to some degree one of their kind in Arizona against Jeff Flake, and they are going to be energized as a result if they see Moore win this race.
Nancy, last word.
Yeah, just one last thing that's a little bit of an ironic point to make just from the White House's perspective on that. You know, the White House itself has become in recent months like much less of an insurgent White House than it started out as. You know, a lot of the Trump campaign people have left. I was talking to a source yesterday who said that all of the entrepreneurs in the White House, as he called them.
You guys couldn't see the air quotes, but
that's a great euphemism, the entrepreneurs.
You know, people like, for instance, Steve Bannon, who were, you know, real insurgent figures in the White House who didn't have a specific portfolio. You know, a lot of those folks are gone now, and you're left with General Kelly, who has much more of a military style approach to running the White House. And there's very few campaign people left. And so it's interesting that, you know, Trump has this whole insurgent support. Meanwhile, his White House has slowly kind of turned into this government place that's obsessed with process.
It's a great point to make.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I will note, there's been a lot made of this idea that like Steve Bannon's going to wage war against Mitch McConnell in these GOP Senate primaries. The way McConnell world views that is sort of as a joke, because they basically think Steve Bannon's been waging war on Mitch McConnell since 2012. Without any success.
Yes,
and they don't really see why he would suddenly start succeeding now. They're a little bit worried that Bob Mercer, who is Bannon's sort of money man, might put more money into these races, and that could be a bigger problem. But the idea that, you know, Bannon, just by retaking control of Breitbart, is suddenly going to be able to cause primary problems, they're not afraid of that.
I think that's a great point about Mercer. That's one that we should definitely be keeping an eye on.
If you had to say, here's your lightning round question, who wins?
I would have to go with Moore. I wouldn't want to put any money on that bet.
All right. Well, fortunately, it's only being preserved for posterity here. So we can check in next week. And I don't know, maybe we'll like set up a dunk tank or something if you get it wrong.
Ooh, Kevin, dunk tank. I love that.
Can we fit that in the studio?
Yeah, we might have to do it in a separate location. Kevin, thank you so much for being here today.
All right. Great to be on.
Alrighty, for our final segment this week, we are going to check in with Donald Trump's approval ratings and how the White House is performing right now. So our data point for this one is 40%. That is President Donald Trump's approval rating in the latest average from Real Clear Politics, and it is doing something it hasn't done for months. It's going up. Now, Charlie, 40% is still quite unhealthy for a president in the first year of his first term, but the upward movement is an interesting sign here for the White House. What could be behind it?
Yeah, I'm glad you put the caveat in there. The business about Trump's numbers in general are historically low for a first year president, and that's an important point to keep in mind. And it's one that I hope people keep in mind as they read the story and pay attention to the poll numbers, because there's a ton of interest in it. I noticed yesterday on our website, our story about this had a ton of traffic, and you can just imagine where it's coming from. It's from, you know, Trump supporters are like, America, F yeah, you know, like Trump, MAGA, and then a whole bunch of apoplectic or morose liberals just like, I can't believe it. What the hell is wrong? But either way, there's a ton of interest in this. And it's important to keep in mind when you're talking about his poll numbers right now, they are still historically low. But having said that, there is evidence of a slight uptick in his approval ratings. And after months of declining poll numbers, his approval rating is ticking upward by a couple of points. And now that might mean nothing, but at the very least, he has arrested this gradual decline that in the poll ratings that have marked his first year in office. And so then the next question is, what's driving it? I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, there's not a ton of data out there right now. We're just basing it on, you know, maybe a handful, a little more polls that have come out recently, but it has coincided with his leadership on the hurricanes, on hurricane response, and it has coincided with a more disciplined White House approach that we've seen under General Kelly.
Well, one thing that I thought was interesting was there was a new Wall Street Journal NBC poll that came out yesterday or this morning that asked sort of specific questions about those rising poll numbers. And it was something like, you know, 71%, sort of the largest percentage of people who, you know, were approved of his – newly approved of what Trump was doing, said it was because of that debt ceiling deal that he struck with Democrats. And not just that deal, but the bipartisanship that it represented, which I thought was so interesting because it was sort of an unusual move and out of the box for him. And it also infuriated some conservative groups and also just some House conservatives. But it was interesting that seemed to be that with the hurricane funding seemed to be something that really appealed to people.
And when you look at the crosstabs, it's not as though his numbers are ticking up because it's Democrats who approve of it. I mean, he is dead to them. Like there's, you know, that ship has sailed. But the crosstab suggests some slight gains with independents. And that has been something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention because we tend to talk in terms of his approval ratings are pretty high with Republicans and at rock bottom with Democrats. And that, thus we have the numbers we have. What we don't pay attention to is how bad his numbers are with independents. And that is what skews them so low typically. What I think a lot of this is rooted in, or at least in these recent polls, is that he is showing slight gains with independents who, for the very reasons you just laid out, Nancy, approved of the idea of him working in a bipartisan way. They approve of him staying out of the theater and staying focused on leadership during hurricane response.
I have a related but somewhat alternative theory, and a little bit of a callback to the 2016 elections. I wonder if some of this is just that Trump has been driven out of the news a little bit more than he had been for most of his first 7 or 8 months by these hurricanes, by all sorts of events going on around the world. And we saw during the election that the times when Trump did best in the polls were the times when he dominated news coverage the least. And it was a very consistent movement of the poll that and part of it was a little easier to draw binary there, right? He was dominating the least when Hillary Clinton was dominating the most, and she was not popular either. And the times that she was dominating the most were when her emails were in the news, or when she had that fainting episode in the hot weather after the 9/11 memorial, things like that. So it might not be a perfect comparison, but I wonder if to some extent, and granted he has recently, he's gone to the UN and given a pretty fiery speech about North Korea, and he's declared that, you know, the DACA program would be ending and stuff like that all in the last few weeks. But I just wonder if the focus is off him a little bit, and that maybe people will feel a little more warmly to him when he's not demanding their attention all the time.
So then the bland theory is the less he's in the news cycle, the better off it is for his poll ratings?
Maybe. Hmm. It was in 2016.
I could see that, because when he's in the heart of the news cycle, it tends not to be for the best reasons. I mean, it's not because he has united the country behind a single objective. It's not because of the beautiful rhetoric he's used to touch the hearts of Americans. It always tends to be for a polarizing event or a polarizing discussion that he has initiated, or for a tweet, or for some sort of action that places him as an outlier when countered against his predecessors.
I do think one thing that you brought up is also playing into some of this, though, Charlie, which is just sort of the way the White House has changed a bit in the last few months. And with General Kelly, coming in as the chief of staff, he has brought more order and decision-making process, more order to the decision-making process. And there aren't, you know, sort of people hanging out outside the Oval Office or coming in or sort of slipping Trump Breitbart articles. And so it's much more controlled. And while Kelly cannot control the president by any means, he has done a good job of sort of locking down information among the staff and making sure that only principals come to the meetings. And I think that has given a bit of rhythm to the way the White House functions. And, you know, it's in the news a little bit less in terms of like the leaking and the infighting. I mean, that's still there, don't get me wrong, but it has dampened down a bit.
That's a really an interesting point. So can you envision, Nancy, and you know the White House better than we do. I mean, you are in it neck deep every day. Can you envision a scenario in which the White House operates with some degree of normalcy, say, 1 year into the General Kelly era? So it's been now, we've seen it for what, a month or 6 weeks or whatever. Like, as we go into, you know, early 2018, could you envision a White House that operated that way?
Not necessarily, because you still have – well, here's the point. Two things. One, you still have the president doing his own thing, and there is a general sense among Kelly and his people that you're not going to be able to control the president. And if you can't control the president and his tweets and he's going to cut deals with whomever he likes, then you can only have so much control over the White House. And then two, the other thing is, you know, Kelly has brought a lot of order and a predictable rhythm to the White House, which some people like because it means that their days are like not as volatile or unstable. But also not everyone likes that. You know, people miss sort of being able to freelance a little bit in the White House. And also people are burnt out. I have a story coming out tomorrow about how there's a bunch of White House staffers who are already starting to look for jobs 8 months into the administration, which is pretty early to have people start looking for the exits. And, you know, if you have more staff turnover, even beyond the huge amount of staff turnover we've already seen, then that just means like the power landscape of the White House keeps shifting with a president who can be pretty unpredictable on top of that structure.
The one thing I'd be watching is, you know, once this happens, once the second wave comes in, you know, what kind of talent gets attracted? Because, I mean, you can make a couple arguments. You know, I've heard some people around town think that, you know, it's the second – once the second tier comes in, they tend to be not as good as the first tier in most administrations. But here I would argue that many of Trump's problems in having a chaotic White House were rooted in a junior varsity talent pool that he brought to Washington with him. I mean, when you look at some of the folks that came in, you know, that you're not talking about the cream of the Republican crop there. You know, you're talking about people who even among Republicans were looked on with some degree of suspicion, who are not thought to be A-listers. You know, I would argue that Spicer was a perfect example. The person who ended up being the face of the early administration, you know, I always found, in our dealings with him to be subpar and possibly, you know, one of the weakest communicators in that entire party. And I thought across the board, you could often find people like that. I don't think most people would, many Republicans would say that Seb Gorka was the top of the, Republican list in terms of foreign policy thinkers. So my question is then who comes in and what effect do they have on the administration?
You might get really smart people coming in. I mean, you certainly could. But I think that one problem is that there's ongoing Russia investigations.
Yes.
And that there are staffers who, you know, don't make that much money in the White House, who work horrible hours, who are having to hire lawyers who charge, you know, upwards of $1,000 an hour. Not necessarily that new staffers would be subjected to that, but that just has put another sort of pall over the White House and people who are currently in it. And I feel like that will make people ultimately a little bit wary about going in, even though, you know, White House jobs are White House jobs. That's really attractive. You can get your phone call returned. Anyone will meet with you. So I think that people will be weighing that power versus the investigations.
That's such a great point. And just this week, we've seen some stories come out that really it seems like the pressure is ratcheting up. With these, especially with regard to Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman. We're going to have Darren Samuelson back in to give us an update on how the special counsel investigation is going. But that still strikes me. That's the cloud of unpredictability hanging over everything that always makes it dangerous to record thoughts about Trump's poll numbers that will come out later, because you never know what might break in a few hours or a few days or a few weeks that could totally blow all that up and dominate what we're talking about with this president for the next however many days.
Right, it might happen today to this podcast. I mean, it's happened to us before where we record it, we get it produced, and then boom, something happens.
The Nerdcast curse.
Yeah. It's like the Sports Illustrated cover.
Maybe we should just cut our losses and end this episode now.
Okay, I'm game for that.
Thank you for being here, Charlie.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And Nancy, thank you as always.
Oh, thanks. I love coming on here.
And as always, a big thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can email us your questions if you have them at nerdcast@politico.com. We'd love to hear from you. And remember, please subscribe, rate us, and if you have time, write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. So once again, thank you to our panel. Thanks to you for listening. Thank you to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, and Nerdcast researcher and Politico Playbook producer, Zach Montalaro. We will talk to you again next week.